Belgioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft the full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Belgioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Belgioioso, every cheese is a specialty.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Extra Serving, a podcast from Nation's Restaurant News. I'm Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of NRN, joined by my fellow sleepy editor, executive editor, Alicia Kelso. Alicia, we are back from Restaurant Leadership Conference, and we are both really discombobulated from time changes and lack of sleep. How are we feeling?
Discombobulated.
And lack of sleep.
Tired.
Yes, we okay. So for those who have never been to Restaurant Leadership Conference, this is really, I mean, it is one of the biggest events for restaurant leaders every year. Happens in Scottsdale, suburb of Phoenix. It's just packed with stuff in the best possible way. And that stuff includes, of course, great sessions. It includes incredible networking, offsite activations, great food, and lots of talking as we were just sharing with each other. It's mentally taxing, but all of it very, very worth it. Alicia, what was the highlight of RLC for you this year?
For me?
Yes.
A professional milestone in that I got to interview Olympic gold medalist Gabby Thomas on stage, on the main stage on day two. And she is probably the most extraordinary person on the planet. I mean, she was undeniably inspiring and she has a tie to the restaurant industry, which made it, you know, her personality, her resume, everything. She's not just a track and field star. Of course, she's got, you know, degrees from Harvard and a master's from Texas. And she's trying to solve the health disparity access issue for underrepresented communities, you know. But she's also she also worked in the restaurant industry. She worked for McDonald's. She worked for Hardee's. She was raised by a single mom who was a server. And then went on to get her teaching degree, and now is a professor at the University of Michigan. So I got to give a Go Blue shout out, which was a lot of fun for me personally. And then, of course, you know, last year she partnered with Cava, and that partnership continues. And that was relevant because last year at RLC, Cava was a Pacesetter Award winner just because of their growth and their stunning, you know, meteoric growth, if you will. So it was just a really, really cool experience. Of course, there were a lot of other really cool takeaways from that event. I missed Marky Mark because I had an interview, but I'll go and watch that later.
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg was a lot of fun. I mean, look, celebrity keynoters, you know, you do these at events to put butts in seats, but these people are also, we're picking celebrities for, they're celebrities for a reason, right? Mark Wahlberg has had a remarkable career, somebody who got in a lot of trouble as a kid, but then came up as first a model, singer, then actor, has been nominated for Oscars. Now he's producing and being in the spotlight for as long as they are. They're just really entertaining. And so his talk was great. I got to shake his hand, get a picture, which was fun. But I got to say, I mean, and I'm not just saying this, Alicia, that Gabby Thomas interview is going to stick with me for a long, long time. You did a phenomenal job, because it's not easy to make a person, especially of that caliber, feel comfortable and get really interesting content out of them. But you did a really good job doing that. And I like you, brought home one of those signed batons. They handed out a few of those. There you go, right there. And I gave it to my daughter, Mabel, and she's already taken it to school for her.
Nice of you. I kept mine. I didn't give it to my kid.
Yeah. Who cares about him?
Don't touch.
But so my daughter, Mabel, she's obsessed with Simone Biles and really followed closely during Paris Simone Biles. And we've watched the Netflix documentaries on her. She's very inspired by Simone Biles. And I will admit, prior to the Gabby Thomas activation at RLC, I was aware of her and how she won, you know, gold medal. But we're going to go watch that sprint show on Netflix now that has Gabby Thomas. And to circle back on what you're saying here, you know, she's not just one of the, if not the fastest woman on the planet. She has a neurobiology degree from Harvard, people. I mean, and she's 28 years old and she's accomplished so much. Point being, she's an inspiration to me, to you, but like to my 8-year-old daughter, who's going to, you know, really cherish that. And, you know, we find people who have restaurant connections. Of course, she had a great restaurant connection. Mark Wahlberg, of course, has his brand Wahlburgers. He brought Paul Wahlberg, his brother, who is the chef and founder of that brand. And so that's all it's, you know, educational from a restaurant perspective. But what you really love to hear from these people is the inspiration. They've all overcome so many challenges in their lives and they have truly accomplished the pinnacle of their careers. And that's a lot of fun. So totally highlights for me as well. There were just so many great sessions on the stage, really drilling in from a restaurant perspective. Credit to our colleague Jonathan Mays and his interview with Kevin Hochman, Restaurant Leader of the Year. Kevin, of course, partly responsible, alongside his team, for helping Chili's achieve one of the most remarkable turnarounds in restaurant history, 31% growth in 2024 for a brand that was really tired and kind of sliding into irrelevancy. Kevin Hochman, George Felix, their chief marketing officer, have completely turned it around. It was the buzz of the event, as it has been the buzz of the industry. And Kevin Hochman's session was particularly good. What did you think about that one?
I loved that session because when you have a case study that strong, as we do now industry-wide in Chili's, like you said, it's a 50-year-old brand. It felt tired. I'm 50. I feel tired. I get it. But, you know, you want to lean in on, he's willing to share what went right. And, you know, everybody's leaning in on what that is. And it was really, hey, keep it simple. Simple is hard, but you must keep it simple. And then he went through a several initiatives that the chain had done to sort of get it back on track. And what kind of interested me was, you know, this visionary study that he did when he was at Procter & Gamble of what he wanted this brand to be. And he put it on the cover of a magazine and he went through these stair-step processes to get it there. And it was, like I said, everything as simple as fixing the roof to fixing wobbly tables to making the fajitas better. And my favorite thing about that interview was, you know, his cautionary tale of quick fixes. And I think us as an industry, especially through this past 5 years of crises overload, really? have been really quick to chase, you know, silver bullets, quick sales through, you know, overcomplicating the menu. LTO. Last year, we had a record number of LTOs and, you know, and our sales were pretty muted, which we'll talk about later. So I liked that cautionary tale because I think it's important that the industry, especially in an uncertain environment, get back to the basics and do the basics and focus on the simplicity and the core. And if we have somebody like Chili's, that is the case that he's saying that may be more a false suit.
Yeah, great point. And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit more in this conversation. By the way, if you missed out on RLC this year, I do believe we'll have plenty of content. We already do have stories up on nrn.com that you can go check out. There will be more dynamic multimedia content coming out eventually, as we did film lots of video there. So stay tuned for more on that. Also, if you don't know, our parent company Informa owns Restaurant Leadership Conference. We also own the National Restaurant Association show happening in Chicago next month, May 17th through 21st. That is another great show to attend. And then there will be FS Tech and Create later this year. Do stay tuned for all of our excellent events that you can check in with lots of this great dynamic content. Okay, let's jump into headlines. There were still headlines, even though we were all in Scottsdale. The industry decided to carry on without all of us.
How dare it.
Make some headlines. Let's start with Starbucks. Starbucks, of course, been in the news a lot lately as Brian Niccol continues to tinker with this brand to try to get it to back into growth mode. The latest is a new dress code. Starbucks is going to ask that employees start wearing neutral colors. And in order for that green apron, the signature green apron, to really pop, they want that to be the icon of Starbucks, and so are asking their employees to wear those neutral colors. They are also offering new uniform pieces of shirts and pants too, in order to accommodate that for employees, I believe for free, so that they can do that. There is a lot of ire coming out about this. Alicia, tell us more about this, Polly.
To put it politely, do you ever go down the Reddit rabbit hole?
No, I don't. I avoid the Reddit rabbit hole.
Do not recommend, but it is so, it's like, you know, it's like a car crash. You can't look away. But when this news came out, the news itself is not surprising. This is one of those basic pieces that he's trying to put back into place. And of course, I am not a Starbucks partner, so I didn't think anything twice of it other than the news, you know, on its head. So, okay, they're going to, you know, enhance the green apron as a symbol for the company. And that goes along with everything else that they're trying to do. And then you start seeing, you know, the comments all over social media, Reddit and elsewhere from those Starbucks employees. And I mean, they're very angry, and naive me had to go figure out why. And, you know, and some of this stuff, I guess, if you're a partner, makes sense. You know, the company modeled itself to be different than other restaurants. And celebrates diversity and encourages people to be individual, you know, express themselves and authenticity and all that. And a lot of people believe that this is going to take away from that, sort of removing that humanization and personalization that the company has long championed from its employees. A lot of other employees found it offensive, I guess would be an appropriate word here, that the company had this line of, hey, we're going to go ahead and give you two shirts at no cost. And so, you know, a lot of employees are going to have to buy new wardrobes to adhere to the solid black color scheme and khaki black or blue denim bottoms. But hey, we're going to throw you a bone here with two free t-shirts. So a lot of folks were upset about that and thought it was kind of patronizing. The folks that have been involved with the unionizing are a little upset that this is what the company seems to be focused on rather than addressing actual issues like understaffing, for example. And, you know, they believe there is a wage issue, or they wouldn't be unionizing in the first place. So that is, they're forcing baristas to change their wardrobes, offering two t-shirts as a you know, a little bit of a concession, but they're not focusing on understaffing or wages or guaranteed hours or some of these other big things that the union in particular is focused on. So that's where we're at here.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, I'm of two minds here. The first is, totally respect everybody's desire to express their individuality. And by the way, that can improve hospitality. I mean, if your baristas, your employees are happy and comfortable in their own skin, they are more apt to display that personality to the employees and make a connection in that way, offering hospitality. I'm also of the mind to where I'm a little cynical on this. You know, Alicia, you and I have been working long enough to remember that there have been dress codes forever at jobs. I mean, I will not, you know, the first 10 years of my career, I couldn't wear jeans to work. You know, granted, completely different job. I have a desk job, so just recognize that, of course. And it's only been the last 5 to 10 years that people have started to embrace more business casual in our line of work, certainly more so than Starbucks. I guess the point I'm trying to make here is it also kind of connects to the work from home, return to office movement going on too, which is that when you are comfortable in a certain way of doing your job and your company asks you to reverse that in any way, shape or form, it kind of sucks because it's like, when our company asks us to go put more time into the office, it's hard because it's like, well, I've gotten so comfortable doing this at my home. This is similar to that, which is when I'm going to ask you to change how you dress, but I'm so comfortable in doing what I dress already. I'm not trying to make light of this, of course. I guess I'm just trying to say, I do think this is a minor thing. This would be a weird hill to die on, for example, for the union, because I think it's a fine move. I do think that embracing that apron makes a lot of sense. Brian Nichol has not so far steered many brands wrong in trying to create icons and sub-brands within the brands he's worked for. I think this is a good one to do. Perhaps they could have done it better. Perhaps they could have offered more free clothing for their staff. But I guess it's all to say that restaurants forever have had uniforms. And this is really no different. It's just that reversing the lifestyle that baristas and other employees have had to date so far, it's a hard change to make. I just suspect that once they make that change, they might look back and say, maybe that was all about nothing.
Yeah, I agree. It's a weird hill to die on. But I also, I don't know if I have a strong opinion about this. I get both sides. And you're right. Restaurant brands have uniforms for a reason. Companies, all companies have uniforms. Most companies have uniforms. And then the argument that, you know, Starbucks was different because we didn't, though, you know, does come into play. But they always had that green apron. So it seems weird that they're mandating certain uniform look to, you know, but they still have the apron. I don't know. I don't have a dog in this fight, but it is always interesting when you have a little bubbling up of uprising or disappointment or disenchantment or what disengagement from employees. And Starbucks, it's the last thing Starbucks needs, frankly. So I think it's worth watching. I think it will hopefully for Starbucks blow over. But it's worth watching because it's the last thing that this company needs.
Certainly the relationship with its employees is important, especially considering 40,000 locations worldwide. Starbucks already has a tenuous relationship with the employees. So this will be another step in that battle for sure. Let's shift to full service news. Now, full service casual dining was really a topic of conversation at RLC this week, mostly because of the struggles and difficulties that lie ahead. Of course, we talked a lot about Chili's. We had, you know, lots of experts from Chili's talking about that, really holding that up as a case study and success in the full service industry. But by and large, not a lot of people feeling super optimistic about full service right now. And thinking, of course, about tariffs, the state of the economy, consumer sentiment, all of these being very steep hills to climb for the full service industry. Let's start by talking about Red Robin. Red Robin, a casual dining brand that has actually been, I think, more or less a success story in the past couple of years. CEO GJ Hart put together a transformation plan that seems to be working. I think certainly when you compare to most of the rest of its competitive set, it's in a fairly good place. Red Robin just announced that they are going to put out, or they did put out, a bottomless burger pass, which includes a month's worth of burgers just for $20, one burger a day alongside a bottomless supply of a side. This really rings of Applebee's and the date night pass they put out. We'll get to Applebee's here in a second. Alicia, you are just fresh off of filing a story about how it crashed Red Robin's site. Go figure. This is obviously another attempt at providing value in casual dining. What do you make of Red Robin's bottomless burger pass?
The crash site is a story.
Yes.
But let's put that story over here, right? And let's zoom out a little bit and just contemplate the bigger story from where I'm sitting, is the fact that a casual dining concept, which is in the middle of a turnaround strategy, per your point earlier, that turnaround is gaining traction, albeit slower than GJ Hart or anybody would like, because of the debilitating challenges from a macro perspective. So let's consider that. And the fact that they had to put out, or felt that they had to put out, or did put out a promotion that was this aggressive, a 20, and that's where I think we are now, where especially low income restaurant consumers have just left the industry in droves, and sales are turning around at Red Robin. Traffic, I believe, is still muted. Not just at Red Robin, but at most casual concepts, as you discussed. So when this promotion came out before the site even crashed, I was like, whoa, I guess that's where we are now, right? Of course, they don't want a loss leader. GJ Hart is brilliant. And, you know, so this was a pass that was offered on a very limited basis. They're not going to give away the farm here. We get emails in our inbox from people who think we're the brand all the time.
Which makes no sense to me.
Our email address is at the bottom of the story. I wrote this story on the bottom. I had dozens of emails. Hey, where can I get this pad? And so the interest was definitely there. And then the site crashed and I started getting emails again. And I was traveling, so I didn't know what was going on. And I got home at 1:30 in the morning and I didn't know what was going on. And then I realized their site had crashed under the weight of this demand. I don't know if they were anticipating this. I think they said they had 12 million visits within a matter of minutes, you know, which for a brand that is the size of Red Robin's not a huge brand, right? It's public, but it's not huge. So that is a pretty stunning influx of visitors. The pass is sold out. The site is fixed. It, you know, I don't know if a brand the size of Red Robin probably doesn't have the infrastructure to support that big of an influx. But this is, I think, a bigger story in that the value environment that, you know, was created in earnest during about the second quarter last year is evolving aggressively because traffic remains muted. In fact, the fourth quarter was the only positive quarter for traffic in, I think, 3 or 4 years. This is where we are now as an industry. This is where we are now as a casual dining segment. This is not the first time this has happened, though. You know, Applebee's crashed for date night pass, like you mentioned. I think that sold out in 1 minute, and I had the same influx of emails to me. McDonald's and Wendy's both crashed their app for National Cheeseburger Day deals about a year and a half ago. And I went down the rabbit hole for Reddit then too. And, you know, the customers threaten boycotts and they're disappointed. And how could they not keep the site live? And they always come back. So, you know, I just think this is a bigger story right now. And the fact that we are evolving and getting really creative with these promotions to try and woo customers into our restaurants.
And this is a classic example of all news is good news, because no matter if their website crashed, no matter if you're getting a slew of emails, and I'm sure they're getting a lot more about angry customers, we're all talking about Red Robin. That's the point. Because yes, to your point, Alicia, you don't want it to be this massive loss leader. So you extremely limit the number of passes available. And did they even say how many there were? They might not have said. Maybe
they didn't.
No, maybe there were only 5 of them.
Maybe.
And they don't lose any money on this, but it's a huge marketing win. Because what are they also doing? They're also putting out a new menu right now. So there's a new menu rolling out. We're all talking about Red Robin. People go and they miss out on the burger pass, but then they learn about the new menu. So I do think this is smart. We're going to get to, you know, of course, Applebee's and Date Night Pass here in just 1 second, I promise. But, you know, it came up at RLC. Again, we talked a lot about the full service space. Jonathan and I did a live Quick Bites from the Stage. And we talked a lot about full service and Chili's. And, you know, one of the things he and I were both kind of talking about is this fact that, you know, for full service, they have an operations challenge. This is where Chili's has really thrived. Kevin Hochman came in, made a lot of operational changes around improving quality and efficiency so that the brand could, you know, sustain the growth that came its way. But it is also a big marketing thing. It is a matter of convincing customers to either give you another visit or come back if they've left. And we all know how Chili's pulled that off with social media. Value is a big, big piece of the marketing strategy this year for full service, no doubt, because of course, customers still want value, increasingly want value. Inflation's hitting everybody's wallets. And I think this is just, you know, a perfect example of the demand for value today that Red Robin site crashed. But they obviously knew what they needed to do, get people to pay attention again, and that was provide value. This is a massive value, $20 for one burger a day and bottomless sides. That, you know, doesn't make any sense, of course, from a business point of view, but it is an effort to get us all talking about the brand. So to that end, I say my hat off to you, Red Robin. However, let's go look at the other case study, Applebee's. Applebee's put out the Date Night Pass 2 years? Has it been 2 years?
No, it was early 24. It's January 24.
So about a year and a half ago, Applebee's did the same thing. Same thing happened. You know, huge demand. Everybody was talking about it. It did not turn Applebee's business around. I think we were all, it put Applebee's in the headlines, but Applebee's did not have a great 2024. So why do you, is this apples and oranges, no pun intended here, Alicia, or why do you think this could work for Red Robin possibly and it didn't work for Applebee's?
I think it comes down to the whole what is the root issue of the issues? Is it operations? Is it operational execution? Or is it marketing? I don't believe Applebee's struggles are a marketing thing. I just, because of the success of the date night pass, because of this, you know, obviously there was a huge tailwind from Fancy Like, you know, a year and a half prior. I think the NFL partnership is, it makes perfect sense for a bar and grill concept. You know, I think Applebee's marketing has been, you know, good. You know, they did adjust their marketing strategy and their value strategy the second half of last year because they were focusing a little bit too much on LTOs versus that comprehensive value, full meal type things that Chili's had done. What I think has happened then is that they were probably too late to that value conversation and they had already lost some share to Chili's because Chili's just took advantage of them being late. So I guess I contradicted myself. Maybe it was a little bit of a marketing thing, but not the bells and whistles marketing, more the value side of the marketing. But I think Applebee's here has a really strong cadence of menu launches. It just brought back, you know, its chef Shannon, who is working on new platforms like hand-breaded chicken and stuff. The products are there. So they have a base to build on. They just don't have a chief marketing officer now.
That's right. Chief marketing officer Joel Yashinsky, a good friend of the pod, took the job at Burger King. A big promotion, you might say, of certainly going to a much bigger system. He did a great job, of course, at Applebee's as far as, again, a lot of great marketing campaigns that were very much in the headlines. Goes to Burger King, which, again, I think a great opportunity considering the size and scale of that brand. Of course, Burger King itself, you know, doesn't have a ton of excitement, I would say, at this point in time. But these things always can swing back and forth. Just to touch on Applebee's, though, one last thing I thought about them is, you know, again, if you're looking at this from an operational and a marketing perspective, operationally, Applebee's also just announced that they're partnering with Toast to do a full suite of tech products, including new POS, new handhelds, new KDS, kitchen display system. There's a lot of work that Applebee's has left to do. I think that would be a good move, of course, the technology, improving the operational efficiency of the system, and then big shoes to fill there with Joel Yashinsky. But I think great opportunity for somebody to come in and really support that brand's turnaround, because let's look at what George Felix at Chili's has done at that brand and really using marketing to support it. I've said this before. I really believe any brand can enjoy a renaissance. TGI Fridays, Red Lobster, Hooters, three brands that have filed for bankruptcy in the past year. Any of those, we could be talking about nonstop in the next 3, 4, 5 years, because if you get the right team in place that makes the right strategy decisions, consumers are paying attention. And if you just, if it connects with those consumers, you have lightning in a bottle to some degree, some luck, anybody can come back and do that. Okay. So what do you think, Joel Yashinsky, what do you think his big challenge at Burger King will be?
I think his big challenge is going to be cutting through the noise of a very busy segment. And, you know, the burger segment was really slow last year, you know, per Technomic data, except for maybe like Culver's and Freddy's or some of those mid-majors, fresh to order, by the way, mid-majors coming through. Habit had growth. All of those are fresh to order concepts. And so, you know, that I think will be the biggest challenge, and just trying to get consumers' attention back in a way to a concept that has burger in its name. Consumers are really, really excited about chicken. So, and Burger King's chicken attempts have, you know, fallen woefully short of its competitors to get a big piece of that conversation, that top of mind share, if you will. So I think that is going to be his biggest challenge. Now, I do want to note he was at Applebee's for 7 years, but prior to that, spent almost 20 years in the McDonald's system. So QSR is his bailiwick. I mean, you know, he was the chief marketing officer of McDonald's Canada. So this is his jam, you know. And I also think it's important to note that Joel Yashinsky is a Bowling Green State University graduate, and we would be remiss not to do a little shout out to that Maction happening.
Hashtag Maction, that's right. All of our Mac friends, Mac, of course, the Mid-American Conference, friends of ours.
Whenever I had an interview with Joel, he would jump on Teams decked out in bowling green gear. He just would always meet the moment. So
I'm still looking for that solid Ohio U grad in this space. There's too many Miami grads, Brian Nickel and who was the other big one?
Lauren Shallow.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Anyway, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. Let's pivot to our extra serving of the episode. We want to get into our top 500 data. We talked about it a few weeks ago. We're going to talk about it again because the top 500 is officially live from our friends at Technomic. They published the report this week while we were at RLC. Those sneaky guys, they snuck it out, but we didn't miss it. And of course, we're going to have a full recap of the top 500 here in a couple of months. In June, we'll have the full 500 and a comprehensive look at that. But we want to start by talking about some of the highlights of the top 500. And doing so, we're going to bring in our senior editor, Joanna Fantozzi. Joanna, welcome.
Hello.
Joanna, we've talked a lot about performance of major brands in this episode. Most recently, we were just talking about Red Robin and Applebee's, the challenges that brands have. The top 500 that we now have officially really plays out a lot of the macro headlines in the industry where we see certain categories, brands, the positioning of all of them, performance that they had in 2024. Joanna, what were some of the highlights of the top 500 data for you?
Well, for me, I was actually really surprised by some of the major categories did, even more so than Chipotle jumping spots, for example. But for me, something that was really interesting is some of the surprising winners and losers. Perhaps not so surprising is that beverages is just one of the hottest categories out there. I should stipulate beverages that aren't Starbucks and Dunkin'. Sorry, Starbucks and Dunkin', and they are just doing incredibly well. Coffee, specialty beverages, energy-based beverages, but also just some of the specialty sodas. And something else that's a kind of a surprising winner has been some of these emerging Asian brands, things like bubble tea, hot pot, Korean barbecue. All of these are just doing incredibly well, and that's kind of surprising to me. Something that I took note of was how I don't want to use the word loser. That sounds bad.
But, oh, come on. You right. Can throw some words around.
So a category that didn't do so hot this year was pizza. And
losers.
Jeez. So more than half of the – I crunched some numbers before. More than half of the pizza chains in the top 500 were in the red sales-wise, and that included Pizza Hut and Papa John's. The best performing pizza chain was Mr. Gotti's Pizza. I'm not super familiar with them. They had just over 10% sales growth. And then to compare what that means in terms of other categories, in the coffee and beverage categories, I counted them. 19 chains did better sales numbers in 2024 than the top pizza chain. And I just think that this kind of emphasizes how kind of important little treats and kind of to quote Parks and Rec, treat yourself kind of mentality is important for the younger generations. They're going out and having fun beverages, especially if they have a drive-thru lane, i.e. 7 Brew. And they're not apparently having pizza, or at least not chain pizza. So those were just some highlights that I thought were really interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, what I would say about that with pizza is, did we find a ceiling for pizza, right? Because let's face it, no, pizza's not going anywhere. People are still buying their pizza, and all those pizza chains you mentioned are still doing many billions in sales. It's just that they stopped growing. And, you know, that could be a saturation issue. It could be everybody maxed out on pizza during the pandemic issue. It could be, who knows, maybe it's more people taking Ozempic and looking out for their, you know, their health, and they want to eat less pizza. Now, counter to that, the indulgence of the coffee beverages in the drive-thru, not doing a whole lot for the health, mm-hmm. Certainly not very healthy beverages in that space. But, you know, it is a little different, is a little bit more of the indulgence versus the I do pizza X nights a week. So I don't know. That's my suspicion. But I think one of the interesting things about pizza, to your point, Joanna, there's not a lot of excitement in the pizza industry. Several years back, of course, fast casual was like blowing up the list, and we had saw Maz and Blaze racing up the rankings. and then just totally ran out of steam and, you know, fell back down to earth. I couldn't pinpoint to you right now what's the most exciting thing going on in pizza. You know, I think there was some activity in full service pizza. I hear rumblings of pizza by the slice maybe being kind of the next wave of pizza. But by and large, I suspect that value in pizza is going to be the name of the game, certainly this year. And maybe next year we start to see some of these major pizza chains like Papa John's and Pizza Hut taking off. Alicia, I know you had thoughts certainly about the coffee brands. Tell me, what were some of the other highlights for you from
Tupper? I want to share a theory that I have about pizza being a little muted. I think it is largely because that delivery has leveled the playing field on convenience.
Great point.
You know, pizza has always been the go-to, especially for families, busy families. And now you don't have to just pick pizza when you have your kid's having a slumber party, or there's everything just accessible to be brought to you. And I think that has long been pizza's advantage. So that's my theory on why pizza struggled versus other categories last year. Yes, to Joanna's point, the whole coffee, and I say that in quotes because I go to 7 Brew and I'm looking for coffee, but I am also a 7 Brew junkie, and I have my little 7 Brew shirt on today. Up 163%. They have a goal to reach over 2,000 units. And then we see Dutch Bros getting, you know, surpassing 1,000 units. And then I think there were 15 total coffee players that exceeded double digit growth last year, including Scooters, Big B, Ziggy's, name it. And we have talked on this podcast before about Starbucks's issues, and, you know, there are several. There's a confluence that you could probably point to. But I think the most underrated one is the fact that these are convenient players that are popping up everywhere and taking, you know, consumers' eye off that ball. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. There's 3 7 Brews within a 5-mile radius of my house and only 2 Starbucks. And the Starbucks are drive-in and park, you know. So I don't want third place when I'm on the way home from school drop off. I need quick and easy. And so I think that category is going to be fun to watch, you know, for the foreseeable future. As mentioned, it does seem that they're taking away from Starbucks' market share of sales, which was 64% in 2018 and 62% last year. We've seen other reports aside from Technomic's show that Starbucks and Dunkin' have both lost traffic share to the tune of about 8%, while these mid-majors are gaining traffic share. Just a huge story. I'm also really, really super intrigued, you know, of course, by Chipotle, that wasn't even in the top 10 5 years ago, is now number 7. Raising Cane's, I think, will be there very, very soon. And so, you know, I always find it fun when this comes out just to see. The top 5 has remained unchanged in 10 years. The top 10, however, has been all, you know, a lot of Panera has fallen out. Domino's fell, I think, was 7 and is now 9. So I think the watching the leapfrogs of the blue chips is kind of really interesting. And, you know, of course, I'm a little bit of a KFC homer because I live in Louisville, and they have just been leapfrogged left and right.
Yeah.
In that really intense chicken category. So interesting times.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Joanna, you have something to add? You want to say that?
I was just going to quickly say that something about the beverages that is really interesting to me is the regions there. I cannot go to any of these. I was talking about 7 Brew and Dutch Bros in our TikToks, and I wanted to sample it on camera. I can't do that in the Northeast. And I feel like we're spoiled. As a New Yorker / New Jerseyan, we're kind of spoiled. A lot of brands tend to start in the Northeast, but when it comes to these drive-through coffee brands, not so much.
You and your privilege in the Northeast. Although that in the Midwest, we finally get ours.
Yeah.
So to just to follow up there on Alicia, your point, top 5, to your point, McDonald's, Starbucks, Chick-fil-A, Taco Bell, Wendy's. There is like a then like $6-7 billion. I think I missed Dunkin', but then there's like a $6-7 billion gap before the next wave. And there's a lot. They're very, very, very close. It may not seem like a lot when these brands leapfrog each other. We're all nerds because we follow this so closely. But I do think it's noteworthy because you really do see shifts in momentum when you see where these brands land on a list like this. And to say that Chipotle now lands at number 7 it might take time, but it could start knocking on the top five's door. But again, because of that big gap, it'll take a little bit of time. But it just shows you the direction that the taste of American consumers are going. I think that's why it's so significant. And I just want to make sure to really drill on a chicken very quickly, because to your point, Alicia, KFC, once a staple of the top 10, is now just does less sales, only about $50 million less, but that's going to grow quickly than Raising Cane's. Raising Cane's has a quarter of the number of locations as KFC. It has 828 locations to KFC's 3,600 plus. That's a big, big deal. Popeyes could pass KFC in the next couple of years as well. And so, again, shifts in where American preferences are going is striking. And again, just to emphasize too, just chicken, really seemingly limitless potential. I agree with you, Alicia. I think it'll only be a few years before Raising Cane's is in the top 10. That will be a big deal. It is already a big deal how fast it's growing. Okay, we need to wrap up because we are out of time. However, I would like to thank Senior Editor Joanna Fantozzi and Executive Editor Alicia Kelso for joining me. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, John Hagen. How long have you been at Walk-Ons?
7 years, oh, almost eight. I guess it'll be 8 years in April. So that's coming up on 8 years. I spent 4 years in our restaurants, managing our kitchens at one of our corporate locations. And then the last 4 years, I've been on the corporate side doing culinary, supply chain, research development, and now most recently, Director of Culinary.
Congratulations. When were you promoted?
Last March, about a year.
So you've been busy because you had to revamp the menu.
Yes, sir.
So talk me through how you guys did that, because it looks like you guys did a fair amount of research into who you wanted to reach, and then you had to figure out how to reach them, right?
Right. Yeah, so we wanted to change our brand identity a little bit, keeping everything the same, but like change the logo a little bit, change the fonts, the textures. And so we identified two key demographics in the sports enthusiast who comes here to watch the games and you know, maybe sit at the bar and have a drink with your friends. That's what Walk-Ons is all about. And we also have like the team mom who's, you know, the millennial mother who comes in with her team after the game. So, but to do that, we also have to like the menu has to look different too, right? So the menu is an intimate connection between every guest and the restaurant. It's something that every single guest touches. It's how they order. It's how they interact with the menu. So that had to not only feature new menu items, but also look different, right? So different fonts and textures, like I said, new logos. We brought back some favorites from the past. We re-engineered some current classics, and then we deleted some opportunities that we had off the menu as well.
So let's talk about each of those categories. What were some of the legacy items that you brought back?
So we brought back the sliced turkey, a great sliced turkey that we have now for a turkey Havarti melt on a great new wheat bun that we brought in. We've also changed the chicken Cali wrap to a more traditional California wrap. So that's a traditional California wrap with a nice garlic aioli, avocado, tomatoes, bacon, lettuce, things like that. And we re-engineered some of our items. Like we had a boudin ball that it was not performing well. It was our 11th out of 13 selling appetizers, and we thought about eliminating it. It was definitely within the threshold of being eliminated or re-engineered, but being a Louisiana restaurant with ties to Cajun cuisine, we wanted to try to keep the boudin but make it better. So that was one item that instead of deleting it, we just tried to re-engineer it. So we've added a pepper jack to it. We made the pieces of pork and rice larger and more visible, and so we totally revamped that boudin ball, and now it's our second best selling. It's 15 days in with the new menu that launched on March 10th, but now it's the second best selling appetizer. So that'll probably plateau at some point and level out, but I mean, it's really selling really well. So everybody who's tried it has raved about it.
That's a pretty dramatic shift.
Especially
for something like boudin, which like if you're in Louisiana, you know what it is, but otherwise people are like, what's boudin or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah.
So, and you guys are expanding. You're getting out of your sort of traditional southeastern territories and going elsewhere, right?
Yeah, yeah. So when we have about 80 restaurants in 15 states, primarily southeast. We've got 20 in Texas, 24 in Louisiana, and then spattered throughout the southeast. But I mean, we're as far west as Vegas, where I am now, in Arizona, and as far north as Indiana. We have a location on Purdue's campus. But yeah, as we grow, right, we have locations in Kansas, Indiana, North Carolina, so Missouri. They don't really know what boudin is, or they maybe they never had alligator. So when you have like a taste of Louisiana, as we say, like it's something that sells, right? I mean, there's French cuisine, there's Italian cuisine, and then there's like New Orleans or Louisiana has its own cuisine. It's recognized around the world. So gumbos, etouffees, red beans, you know, are some of our Cajun classics, boudin, heavy seafood influence, right, with the Gulf of Mexico being right here. So a lot of shrimp, redfish is on our menu. So, yeah.
And so you reworked some items, and I guess you also reworked your devils on horseback. How is that different?
Well, they used to come fried, and you can still get them fried, but they used to come fried, and they would be dipped into a sweet chili sauce, and now we've made them grilled. So, like, we wrap them in bacon, and it's a 16-20 shrimp that we peel in the back of the house, stuff it with cream cheese, stuff it with a jalapeno, hand wrap it in bacon, and secure that with toothpicks. That hasn't changed, but now we grill it instead of frying it, so you get, like, a nice, dark, deep ruby red color on the bacon, which is great. It's very eye-appealing, and then we toss that in a hot honey sauce. It's really great. And we serve that on top of a bed of cabbage. So that's one of my new favorite items, actually. Before the menu launched, I was getting them like that. So, you know, I'll just have them modify it to be grilled instead of fried and toss it in the hot honey sauce, which is a really good sauce. It's been trending for a long time. I don't think that trend's going anywhere. Hot honey is good on a lot of things from all aspects. I mean, desserts even. I mean, hot honey is great. And we have a really good one that I think is, you know, not too vinegar or cayenne forward, but it has a good kick at the end. So really, really happy with that sauce and that new dish.
Well, and moving from fried to grilled is interesting to me because people say they like grilled, but they order fried. So, you know, I mean, was this something to appeal to those moms who are bringing in their softball teams or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, it's a more calorie conscious consumer, right? So perceived healthy is a thing that people often will say, like they want to get it grilled, like you said, because they think it's healthier, but, I mean, the way it presents, it just there's some operational complexity too. When you wrap something in bacon, it comes to us smoked, right? So it's technically ready to eat. We cook it a little bit longer and then we fry it. But if you batter something like bacon, it also has the perception sometimes of being undercooked. So that was like it was never undercooked, but it would look that way if you peel it off. Like they're big, right? So you're not usually eating that in one bite. So it's a two bite dish. And so you would bite it, and then you would see the bacon, and you'd think it's undercooked. So to eliminate some of that, you know, guest perception of it being undercooked, we now grill it, and so it has like it looks beautiful with the ruby red color, and then it's tossed in hot honey that just accentuates that red color.
Well, I guess if you batter bacon, then it can get soggy. It can steam inside the batter, and so then.
Yep, because we didn't change the alligator, we kept it the same. But the devils, for example, was not ordered often, but when it was often, had a very, very high satisfactory rate, actually the highest of our appetizers. So that's one that we wanted to highlight, create a signature item around it, an all-star item, and really promote that as a new dish, a re-engineered dish that people will be more comfortable ordering. Because like I said, when they order it, they like it and they come back for it. But they just, you know, maybe they're not used to a wrapped shrimp or something like that. I'm not really sure. But yeah, so not often ordered, but when it is ordered, super high satisfactory rate. So that was one that we wanted to make sure that we highlighted as an all-star item.
But you were saying something about the gator, probably not the ordered that often because it's alligator.
Okay, so alligator is tricky. So when we open up a new restaurant, let's say Kansas, for example, we'll go through 8 cases in a week. We can't keep it on the shelf. Like people will try it because they're not used to it. They're like, is that really alligator? Yes, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. It is alligator. You should definitely try it. Blackened or fried. It's great. It comes with a Dijon horseradish. Highly recommend it. But it's not something that people, you know, people like things that are safe, right, and ubiquitous. They want to spend their discretionary income on things that they know are going to be good. So, you know, alligator is not necessarily cheap, you know, to buy. I mean, you get just tail and jaw meat. So we have the best, most tender meat. We marinate it. It's great. But people are, you know, sometimes afraid to buy that, but it does sell pretty well outside of Louisiana.
So they try it once and they think, huh, that's kind of interesting. And then they come back again and they get chicken tenders or whatever else.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which, I mean, that's cool. Like if it brings them in the door, that's all right.
Right.
But yeah. And I've had alligator a few times and it tastes kind of like pork tenderloin. Like it's not a super robust flavor. It's fine, but not really that big a deal, I guess, which I guess is what your customers find out. They say, okay, great, and have it the one time.
Well, it has a high satisfactory rate. I just think that people, they're not generally apt to order it, right? So, I mean, we have 12 apps now. It's not the highest most frequently bought, I guess. But like I said, like with the turf analysis shows us, it's the second highest satisfactory score. So people will try it, and then they'll be pleasantly surprised with it. I mean, we marinated in pineapple juice and buttermilk and hot sauce, so it's got a good flavor to it. It's really tender. I like it blackened, but it comes fried or blackened. But yeah, it's really good. People just don't order enough because I think they're afraid of it to order something new like that. But when they are, I think they're pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, sounds great. So what are your most popular appetizers?
The mozzarella cheese logs are the number one selling appetizer in every single walk-ons in America and across the board. So it's our number one item sold, and it's the number one appetizer sold. So within this category and within the whole overall menu, and we don't really advertise it, you know? I mean, it just becomes naturally the most popular appetizer. I think it is a safe option. People know what they are, but when they try it, I mean, we're hand cutting mozzarella in the back of the house, and then we're hand battering these. So like, it's very labor intensive. And I think that labor of love comes out to the guests. They can just tell without us putting it in their face and trying to advertise it. They can just tell that, like, you can get a ready to eat. You can get a freezer to fryer cheese log out there. And a lot of people do that to save the labor, but it's kind of like the golden goose for us. So when we looked at all these changes, like, that was one that I was like, don't touch the cheese logs. Like, they are the way that they are for a reason. We could find some labor savings. We could find some cost savings in here. But if we change the thing that people like the most, like, that's just, you know, that's not a very smart strategy. So cheese logs are, you know, they're logs, not sticks. So they're pretty hefty. You get five of them with some marinara, and yeah, we can't keep them off the shelves.
But you also importantly changed the look of the menu, right? You got rid of the Louisiana specialties and added seafood specialties or something like that. Different colors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So with the whole creative process, there's a lot that went into it, right? So we teamed up with Norton, who does some menu design work for us on the side. And we had bistro specialties, and we had Louisiana classics, which were just kind of, especially bistro specialties, it's kind of just like a confusing category, especially when you spell it E-A-U-X, right, which we're known for. People just didn't know what that meant or why that category existed. So we changed some things around on the menu. I mean, we went from two columns to three. We eliminated some of the words. We had eye tracking device that showed that our guests would have fatigue going through our current menu. So this one flows a little bit better. We put the seafood specialties up at the top right with a box around it, right, to highlight those items. And then we changed the signature entrees is now what bistro specialties used to be. So it just makes a little bit more sense to the guests. Like, they were confused, so we just wanted to eliminate some fatigue and some confusion. But there's a lot of changes that went into it. I mean, the logo is different. The font's different. Besides just the actual items that we eliminated, like, we eliminated a lot of the words. So it was just very, very wordy the way the menu was. Like I said, we had, you know, we put glasses on that would literally track a guest's eye movement. And so when they would read the old one, they would stop about halfway through the left side, right? So you wouldn't even get to the top, right? They read it like a book, left to right, up to down. But then when they get to the right side, they've already decided what they're going to get. So a lot of these items on the bottom right never got looked at. So we wanted to make sure that we, you know, highlight things within the category. There's a lot of science that goes into that, right? So we moved some items within the categories around. We moved some categories around in the menu, two columns of three, et cetera. So there's a lot that went into it. You know, brand study, the eye tracking. We tested about, I think it was 1,005 guests who had been to walk-ons in the last 6 months to see, you know, what they liked, what they thought, what were their top three entrees, appetizers, cocktails, all those things. So, like, we eliminated things that were not selling very well, the things that we couldn't operationally execute very well. So there's a lot. But, I mean, every space, the menu real estate is valuable, right? So if it's going to go on our menu, we have to be proud of it. And that's what it really came down to. It's something that we're proud of. It's not that we just want to have something for everybody, but we do have something for everybody. But we don't need to please everybody. Like, you can find something on this menu that you like for sure. We know that based on the data. But we don't have to have every single item. So a lot of people are scaling down their menus and just operating really, really well. And that's the direction we wanted to go.
Makes sense. So what are some things that you got rid of?
We got rid of queso. So you could argue that would be on a sports bar menu, but it's just something that we couldn't operate consistently. We sold a decent amount of it. It was an eighth out of 13 appetizers in terms of sales. But I mean, when operated well, it was good, but it takes steam well management. It takes eye to detail. And so again, if we can't nail it every single time, then we'll have to, you know, look at either re-engineering it or reevaluating it or taking it off the menu. So queso is one that we took off the menu, but, you know, we're running tests in the background to see, you know, with a lower viscosity and different starches and thickening agents and stuff like that, like how can we bring it back and make it better? So if we're going to take anything off, like we did with the turkey melt, right? So to switch subjects a little bit, we had the turkey melt on years ago, and we think about bringing it back. We took it off with the avian bird flu a few years ago. Turkey was hard to get. If you could get it, it was very expensive. But if you're going to bring back a turkey sandwich, like how can you make it better? And you can really only make it better by either changing the bun or the cheese or the sauce, right? So we did all three. So we got a better sauce in with sriracha aioli. We got a better cheese, a nice buttery, creamy Havarti cheese. And then we got a better bun, which is a nice, sweet, sweet, delicious wheat bun. So those are the things that you can do to just change it up. If we're gonna take something off and bring it back, we have to bring it back better than ever.
When you're cross-utilizing the Havarti, right? You got it on the turkey melt and the turkey burger. Is that right?
Yep, and the grown-up grilled cheese. It's also on there. So yeah, the Havarti turkey burger, the turkey melt, and the grown-up grilled cheese right now.
Makes sense. And yeah, with it, like with the queso, if you already have mozzarella logs, maybe they can break up the mozzarella logs over whatever they want to put queso on or something like that.
Yeah.
But you also, like half of your menu innovation in terms of actual new items was drinks, which is kind of interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that approach?
Sure. So, you know, one of our internal goals as a sports bar is to increase our beverage sales, both NA and beer, wine, liquor, right? So I think to be the best sports bar in America, you got to focus a little bit more on the bar. So we've always been very food focused, like extremely food focused. So we take that very, very seriously. We want to say that we're a sports bar with better than you expect food, better than average food. Nothing's freezer or fryer, everything's hand battered, etc. But we've oftentimes put less focus on the bar. So we hadn't changed the cocktail menus in several years. So, you know, through a beverage vendor of ours, a consulting company, some menu gap analysis, you know, some turf studies, stuff like that, we looked to see what our gaps were on the menu. And so we eliminated some cocktails that were underperforming, and we brought in 6 new cocktails that have done tremendous in the last 15 days. So one of them was a lemon drop martini, right? So we looked at our data from 2024. We sold 55 lemon drops without having it on the menu. So we had some signature cocktails that would sell less than that. So featured on the menu, some items would sell less than that. So we're seeing that we sold 55,000 lemon drop martinis last year. So we just wanted to make sure that we streamline that, take advantage of it, add strawberry to it, which is the number one trending flavor in the world with cocktails, and then make a great strawberry lemon drop martini, which is now the number one selling cocktail. It's almost 2-to-1 over the previous top selling cocktail.
And it's outselling the espresso martini and the spicy mango margarita, which people buy all over the place everywhere.
It is, but a lot of them, so 4 of the cocktails are in the top 6 of the existing 13. So, but yeah, I mean, the praline espresso martini is another great one. It's near and dear to my heart. I love an espresso martini, but we try to think of like, how can we make it special, right? Everybody has one. Some people like them creamy. Some people like them bitter, whatever that may be. But like, how can we make it unique to walk-ons and unique to Louisiana? So we finally found this great praline liqueur, which really makes it special. When made correctly, you know, it has a nice foam on top, and then we put some cinnamon sugar on top of that. So you get a nice aromatic sip from start to finish. So you'll smell the cinnamon while you're tasting the drink with the praline espresso, the praline liqueur. I mean, it's really good. It's now kind of like has a Louisiana tie to it. So I definitely encourage people to go out and try that one.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to tie in, you know, you're a Louisiana company very much so. So you should have pralines everywhere.
Yeah. And the margarita is the number one cocktail in the world. So, I mean, we have 3 of them, and all 3 of them are in the top 7 of our total signature cocktail sales. So we have 3 of them total. It's top shelf. We have a new spicy mango margarita, which is amazing. It's got an ancho chili liqueur in it. That's really great with the mango puree. That one's probably top 5 with a tahini rim and a lime. That one sells really great. It looks really, it's got a vibrant, you know, golden yellow color to it. So that one looks really great. It sells well. Then we also have a watermelon margarita, which is also in our top 5. So that would be a great summer cocktail for us as well.
And the watermelon comes from Red Bull, right?
Yes.
So that's fun.
Yeah.
Sort of an energy drink, like an espresso martini is, or a Red Bull and vodka, but
yeah, with kind of matches our game day energy vibe, you know.
For sure. So you can really pound those mozzarella logs.
Bel Gioioso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft the full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Gioioso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Gioioso, every cheese is a specialty.